invite you to welcome with you Dr. Don Devon.
Thank you, Sarah. Okay, I got two. I'll probably use them both.
Okay, it's all yours.
Okay, is this off now?
No, it'll be on.
Okay. I don't have to use it, though.
Oh, you don't want to
use it? No, because I got this thingy bop here.
Okay.
Learning all the nuances of recording. This, I am, that nice man back there is recording this, and it'll be on, it'll be available on CD. I think you have that thing in your folders there. And there's also one on sex and love addiction that I have out there that is available as well. I'm not trying to sell these for my own benefit, but I give all the proceeds to the 12-step program that brings me to these places. So, okay.
No.
Okay. Oh, ramp it up a little bit. How's that?
Is it okay if she uses the microphone?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
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 All right, I'll use the microphone.
Okay, there we go. All right.
Okay, so today I was asked to come and talk to you about codependency and the relationship of codependency to addictions, as well as the childhood trauma that creates the kind of codependency that people are experiencing. So first I want to start off with telling you what codependency is. Now, you've been hearing this, but I know that you can hear it and hear it and hear it, and it takes a while for it to really start making sense, even if you can repeat it verbatim. So I will tell you that a couple of things about codependency. Codependency, in a word, is emotional immaturity. That's what it is. When you are in a state of codependence, you are acting less than your age. So if I'm 60 years old and I'm acting like I'm 20, I'm kind of in a state of that codependency. And if I'm acting like I'm 5, I'm really in a state of codependency. All right? So when you are in recovery for codependence, what it means is that you're saying to yourself, I'm going to act my age. And if I decide not to act my age, I know what I'm doing. And if I want to stop doing that, I know how to bring myself back to my age. Now, you can imagine the problems that might exist when you have two people who have different levels of codependence. They're both in their codependent state trying to have a discussion about sex in a relationship. So you have a wounded 5-year-old and, say, a adapted adult 11-year-old. They're both in adult bodies with their adult hormones and everything going on, trying to have a discussion about the problems in their sexual relationship. And you wonder why people have problems in their relationships. This is really what happens. So once you understand about this codependency thing, then you can grow yourself back up when you decide, yeah, I need to have this discussion with my partner right now about something that's difficult. I want to make sure that my 60-year-old arrives with my 60-year-old body. It makes a whole lot more sense, and it makes it really simple. Okay? So that's kind of what one of the things about codependency, and one of the ways it's acted out. Five core symptoms of codependence only happens when you're an adult. Here is a news alert. Children are not codependent. Adolescents are not codependent. One of the really beautiful things about children and adolescents is that they're always acting their age. Always. No matter what they're doing, they're acting their age, and they're doing it exactly right. Okay? So children can't be codependent because they always act their age and because they're not adults. Codependence is an issue that adults have. It's an illness that creates a lot of distress in a person's life. The five core symptoms that create this codependency place that people go to are, number one, issues around self-esteem. I wondered if that was important. Okay, so issues of self-esteem. Now, you might say, okay, well, what does that mean? What that means is that a person who has codependence, when they're in their adult self, they have problems knowing if they're better than or less than. They don't know how to do equal to. Okay? Now, children are always trying to do this because they don't know who they are yet. That's one of their jobs, is to find out who they are. But adults should know something about who they are. Unless, of course, they grew up in a family that created the codependency. Okay? So, when a person has codependence, the way that this issue of self-esteem gets acted out is that the adult is always on guard to figure out, first of all, before they start a conversation, am I better than you or am I less than you? Am I better than you? Am I less than you? Am I better than you? Am I less than you? I go to the grocery store and I go up and ask the guy where the lettuce is. Before I even open my mouth, I have to determine whether I'm better than or less than. And so you can imagine how much energy this takes up all the time. And it's like you're driving down the road and somebody cuts you off. You have to look at the car and see if it's a better than car or less than car for you to decide what you're going to do. Rather than going through your life knowing who you are and knowing that you are equal. Now, I'm also, while I'm telling you about these things, I'll give you little exercises that you can do to deal with these things right away before you even understand what they are, and that's fine. Okay, what you do in order to deal with this particular core symptom of codependence is that with everybody you meet, you look for your commonality. What do I have in common with this person? Whether I'm better than or less than is irrelevant. What matters is what do I have in common with them? Now I'm off the teeter-totter. Okay? So that's one of the core symptoms. How does a person have this issue? Okay, I'll go back to when you're born. Because, oh, by the way, I wanted to tell you that codependence is a direct result, an absolute direct result of childhood abandonment, abuse, and or neglect. It doesn't happen without those things. Now, I'm not saying that you have to be in a perfect family in order to not have codependence. But I would tell you that you will not have these five core symptoms if you grow up in a family where your parents act like grown-ups. And they're not addicts. Because, you know, when grown-ups are acting like grown-ups and they're trying to deal with kids or adolescents, it's like kind of interesting. And I'll get all traumatized and triggered every time they do something. Okay? So I'll bet that none of you grew up in those families, so I won't even go there. Otherwise, why are you here? Gee, it's Saturday. I think I'll go. Okay. Okay. So how does this issue of self-esteem happen in a family that is less than nurturing? So you're born, okay, and you have about 18 inches between you and whoever is holding you, and that's as far as you can see when you're an infant. You cannot see any more than that. If you look around, you just see fuzz. Okay? So the first people you see, are you looking at faces that have joy? Are you looking at face that is really happy to see you and thinks that you're the best thing that ever happened? And as you get handed around to people, is there as many happy, joyous faces as there can possibly be? Because if this happened to you, then you immediately had a sense of value. And you didn't have to do anything to get it except be born. Now, I would suspect that this happened more often, like when my mother was born, things like that, because children way back, at least then, had a sense of value when they were born. When my mother was born, people would come from miles around to celebrate the birth of a child. Because that meant that we were still going to be able to propagate the species. There was going to be somebody to help on the family farm, to take over the family farm. All right? And so whether or not the child thought that they were being valued because they were great humans is irrelevant. When you're a baby, you don't know what they're thinking or why they're doing what they're doing. Who cares? But when the face you see is one of joy, whether it's because they're really happy you're there because you're you, or they're really happy you're there because you're going to help out with the farm. Who cares? You're a baby. You don't know that. So you get handed around, you see all these joyful faces. When you go to bed that night, you're feeling pretty happy because all of those reflections back were joyful. And you get a sense of value. And when that happens over and over again as a child, you keep getting reinforced with, you have value. And even when you're in school, you have value. If you come home and say, gee, I think I'm flunking this course, and your parent sits down with you, or your teacher sits down with you, or the school counselor sits down with you and goes, well, you know, how can I help you with this? No, that must be very distressful to you. What can I do to help you? Rather than, what? And you know the rest. Okay? So when they consistently let you know that you have value, you always know that those faces, there will be some love in there. Even if they are fearful, even if they have pain for you. Okay? Because when you're a child, you can't be a grown-up. It's just not possible. You're just learning. So how are you going to know everything perfect right away? Well, did your parents know everything right? Did they know everything? Do you all know everything? No. So if you're a kid and you're expected to know everything, do you think you're going to have value? No, you're not. And not only that, but you're going to think, well, in order for me to get value, it's going to depend on what I do. So I have to become a human doing, not a human being. So I have to figure out, okay, now if I do this, and if I do this, and if I do this, then I'll have value. And what that turns out to look like in your adult life is that, and if I'm not perfect, it will never be good enough. Is anyone in here do it perfect yet? Oh, not raising my hand. I don't know about that perfection thing. I don't know anyone that's ever done it perfect. But when you're a kid and you don't have value and you always wonder, do I really count? How come when I need that person, I see a back? How come I'm afraid to go to that person and tell them I need them for something because they'll get mad? Or they left and never came back. That's all my fault. Okay, so this is where you get that problem with self-esteem. Now, there's another side of this, overesteem. If you grew up in a family where you were raised above everyone else in the family, where the parents even treated you like you were smarter than them, better than them, where they accommodated you before they accommodated anyone else, then you came out of a place where you're better than. Now, you might wonder, well, if I'm better than, what, would you really be sitting in this room? Probably. Because here's another newsflash. Who wants to be in a relationship with somebody who's better than all the time? It's a lonely place. And it's confusing because other people don't agree with you. And you can imagine how confusing that would be. After all, you're better than everyone else. What is wrong with all these people? But they don't get it. Okay? So that's the kind of abuse that creates that problem with self-esteem. So that's core issue number one. Core issue number two has to do with your reality. And knowing and identifying and owning your own reality. Now, if you wonder whether or not you have this problem, here are a couple of things that you can look at. One is, when somebody asks you a direct question about yourself, how do you feel? Are you tired? Are you hungry? You think you work too much? Okay? And you say to yourself, at least, you might not say to them, but you say to yourself, I don't know. Okay, you're an adult. I'm an adult. If somebody asks me if I'm hungry, if I don't know whether I'm hungry, who knows that? I mean, even as a baby, I knew that one. But if I grew up in a family where there was abandonment, abuse, and neglect, I'm probably not going to know some of those things. The kind of abuse that happens to you when you have problems owning your reality, it happened like this. Whenever you said what your reality was as a child, you were either abandoned, abused, or neglected for it. And I'll give you a couple of examples. One is hunger. That's one of my favorites because it's so easy to understand for me, anyway. Children, when you're born, you are perfect eating machines. You only eat when you're hungry. Okay, there's a lot of adults in here. Anybody that's ever tried to feed a full baby? Yeah, what happens? Gee, you look good in that, Donna. That formula really adds to the way you look today. That's what happens if you try and feed a baby that's full. Okay? So babies are pretty perfect in that way. They only eat when they're hungry, and when they are not, and when they are hungry, you will know it. They will let you know. They'll start screaming like there is no tomorrow, and then when you feed them, they're fine. And we're kind of programmed that way, hard drive kind of things. Then when you start growing up and you can start talking and saying words, and you say, I'm hungry, and you're a toddler, okay? No, you're not. Or, no, you're not, and we're going to eat in a half an hour. You can wait for a half an hour. Or you're 8 years old, and you come home from school, and you say, I'm hungry. When did you eat last? Well, I ate lunch. Well, have this piece of toast over here. You won't be hungry anymore. You go have it. You're still hungry. I'm still hungry. No, you're not. And if you don't leave me alone, you're not going to have dinner. And if you do eat, then you won't, you know, and this whole thing. If you don't eat all your food, then you won't get to have dessert. And why are you crying? Here, take this cookie. You'll feel better. So you wonder why people stop knowing if they're hungry? They stop eating for all the reasons that people are born to eat. That is, to nourish and strengthen your body in order to keep your primary source of transportation functioning for your life. Now you're eating for all these reasons that have nothing to do with hunger. And then, you know, and then you take even little kids, babies. You know, I always say this, it's just so funny to me. How many grown-ups don't like peas? A lot. And when you look at a pea, you say, okay, you remember you're talking about people acting their age? Babies and little kids are also acting their age. And just like they can't see, here's another news flash. Their taste buds are not fully developed when they're born. Okay? So, no, they're not going to like pizza, even ground up pizza, when they're one. It probably feels pretty strange because they prefer to eat things that feel good in their mouth. They like it smooth, they like it soft, they like it to go down easy because they choke otherwise. So, parent puts peas out on their tray and says, eat those peas. And so what's the little kid do? They squash them, smash them up really good, and they think to themselves, I can't read children's minds, but I kind of think if I was 1.5 and I was looking at that piece of squash stuff, I'd think, that looks a little bit like my poop. That's what I think. And they want me to eat that? I don't like the way it feels either. It won't come off my hands. And I don't want to eat that. You eat those peas right now. But I don't want to eat that. You told me not to eat that poop, and that's poop. So this great experience goes on for children. Then they get to be 4. Okay, now we're talking about trauma. So they've been traumatized by peas at an early age. Now they're 4. You will eat those peas before you go to bed. You're going to sit there until you finish those peas. Now you're in a power struggle. This is one of my favorite things. Here's a grown-up whose body is, what, 40 years old or something. And here is a four-year-old who's acting their age. Now you tell me who's not acting their age. The four-year-old, I don't want those peas. You eat those peas or you are not going to bed. But I don't want those peas. I'm telling you that if you don't eat those peas, I'm going to whack you. Who's acting their age here? Yeah. This is not what grown-ups do. If I don't want food as a 60-year-old woman, you can sit there and threaten me until I die. I'm not putting it in my mouth because I know my reality. But see, when you are punished, when love and affection is withheld, when you are beaten because you're not eating those foods or tasting those foods, then you're traumatized by that. And every time that food comes up, you will be back into that ego state that you experienced in that trauma. And that is like you experience when you're 18 months, all of a sudden you're going to feel like you're 18 months old. Or if you're four, you're going to experience it just like you were 4 years old. And then you start to feel kind of crazy. Okay? So that's how your reality gets all kind of whacked out, is you get abandoned, abused, and neglected for stating your reality. I'm hungry. I don't want that. I don't feel like doing that. Not that children need to rule everything that's going on in the house, but their reality. When you're little, think back on it. What would have happened, how you would have felt if when you said, I don't want to go there, say it's church. You've had a rough night, you don't know why, you're too little to understand. It's Sunday morning, and they're going to get you up, and you are going to church whether you like it or not. So you go to school all week, you get up and you do that, and then they want you to get up on Saturday, Sunday, and go to church, or you have to dress up more. And you have to go and sit for a long time. And sometimes mom and dad don't even have to go. But you do. So whenever you walk into a church, you go right, triggered into that old ego state reality of being abandoned for going to church and neglected. I'll send the kids off to church so we can do whatever we want on Sunday morning and everyone will think we're good parents, whatever that means. And then that will be your experience with church at that point. So you don't even, your reality doesn't count. What if your parents would say, hey, why don't you, do you want to get up and go to church today? And you said, no, I really don't want to do that today. It's really nice. I'd rather go on a picnic. And the parents said, well, let's talk about that. It is a nice day, and we do live in the Northwest. Maybe we could go to church on a rainy day. Maybe we could go out and have a family picnic today. So do you think you would feel as resistant to church the next time? No. Because when you grew up, you'd say, well, yeah, you know, I go to church when I want. I don't feel compelled or I'm going to die or I'm going to burn in hell if I don't go. I'm going to go because it means something to me. And if I want to go on a picnic, I'll go on a picnic too. No problem here. No guilt, no shame. So that's one of the core issues around reality. Then we're going to talk about moderation. Now I'm a recovering addict, and I know something about an inability to have moderation. Because my motto was, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing in the extreme. Anybody? Now I know that nobody who has codependence feels this way. Okay, so, you know, I probably don't have to talk a lot about that, but I will tell you that people who have moderation issues, it started out when your children and your primary caregivers acted in the extremes. You reacted to that. So let's say it's Christmas, and people are going to have Christmas dinner and wine with Christmas dinner. If you grew up in an alcoholic family, the first thing that happens when Christmas comes is that you get triggered into that ego state, that you, the same feelings that you used to have when Christmas was coming and you were hoping beyond all hope that this year would be different, and that you were hoping beyond all hope that you'd have that one that Norman Rockwell had going on, but you knew that as soon as the wine came out, that that was just going to go really badly south for you. And you saw your parents get drunk. You saw your dad's face fall in the food. And you said to your, so what did you do? You reacted to that. As a grown-up, you either started doing the same thing, or you went the total exact opposite way. We don't do Christmas, and if we do, there will be no alcohol ever in our lives. Most people just don't want to do Christmas. And then I've seen people who like do Christmas so much that it's way over the top, and they spend all year trying to pay it off. Moderation, if you grew up in a family where their parents had no moderation in their lives, then you are either over to this extreme or that extreme. So that's what moderation looks like, moderation issue. The fourth primary codependency issue has to do with knowing your adult needs and wants and getting them met appropriately. Now, when you and if you have problems with this, it's because you were abandoned, abused, or neglected whenever you said what your needs and wants were. It's really simple. And I'll give you an example of how that happens. So you say to your parent, I need $15 for a field trip at school. Now, sometimes when families don't have this, right, then they just don't have it. But the child doesn't need to feel ashamed or guilty about that. Okay? So a couple things could happen. It's like the parent could say, okay, well, here's your $15 and let me know how that goes, and do they need anybody to go along for the field trip or whatever, things like that. And if they didn't have it, and they could say, if they weren't in their disease, they could say, you know, honey, I just don't have $15, and let's talk to the teacher. I'll talk to the teacher and see if there's a way we can work this out. Or it's not going to be possible, and I know you're disappointed, and I know that this is very upsetting for you. Maybe we can figure out a different way to do that down the road. I'm really sorry that you have to go through this. So if this happened to you, then you weren't filled with shame and guilt. You might have felt some pain and sadness about it. That would be normal. Children need to feel those things in order to know what to do and how to manage them. But most of the time, if you grew up in a family that was less than nurturing, what do you think, you're the only one in this family? What do you think, that we're made of money? You think money grows on trees? See, that's the parent coming from a shame place. I can't take care of my kids. But rather than me looking at that and seeing if there's something else I need to do about that, now I'm going to put it on this needy kid. You're so needy. Newsflash, children are needy. That's part of their role in life. They're also unstable. Has anyone ever heard of a stable child or a stable adolescent? That's because they're acting their age. So if you had a need or a want, and you were made to feel ashamed or guilty for even having that need or want, then this is one issue for you. And what people do, and the way it shows up in the codependency world, is that you either get needless and wantless, I will take care of all my own needs, thank you very much, leave me alone. Or you go over here, and it's like, you're so needy that you're a bottomless pit. And no matter how many friends you get, no matter how much support you get, no matter what you get, it just never feels like enough. It's kind of like your need and want buttons get broken. And by the way, in recovery for codependents, it's really important, A, to know that having needs and wants is really normal, and you don't need to feel ashamed or guilty about that. But you also need to know how to get them met appropriately. And that takes some time. You also need to understand the difference between needs and wants. Needs means that you're not going to be able to live without it, literally. Wants, gee, it'd be nice. And who's going to meet those? Ultimately, if I'm in my adult reality, which means I'm in recovery, if I'm in my adult reality, I know that I'm responsible for me getting all those needs and wants met by myself. You know you have this if you feel this way. You have to tell somebody what you need and want, and if they give it to you, it doesn't count. If that's true for you, this is an issue for you. If you really love me, if you really care about me, you know I need this and want this. After all, you know my terrible history, so you should know this. No, that would be an expectation that, oh, say, a child or an adolescent might have of a parent. That's not what grown-ups do. In fact, when you're in your recovery for your codependency and you're acting like an adult and you say to somebody, you know, what I'd really want is I'd really want to have dinner with you this week. And somebody says, well, that's great. Let's have dinner. Rather than, I can't believe I needed to ask that. You knew it was my birthday. You know, one really big day for me was when I decided that I was going to create my own celebration for my birthday. Rather than wait expectantly for someone to notice and set up some kind of a celebration for my birthday. Because in my family, we didn't celebrate birthdays. So we just, and it wasn't because we were Mormons. It's because we just didn't. And so year after year, from the time I was about that big to notice that other people celebrated their birthday, I would have disappointments because it didn't get celebrated. When I got in recovery for codependence, I went, who's the happiest one that I have a birthday? Me. Maybe I will celebrate. Hey, what a good idea. And I can invite my friends. And if they come, it's not because, oh, gee, I'm the one that had to set this up for you to come. Boy, you know, if you've ever been in a relationship with someone like that, it's like you find yourself saying things like, I can't win. When I do it, it's not enough. When I do it on my own, it's not enough. And when you ask me and I show up, I'm in trouble. So when you're in recovery for your adult needs and wants, you say, here's my adult needs, here's my adult wants. I'm responsible for getting them met. I'm responsible for asking to get them met. And by the way, if they say no, that's a cause for celebration. One of the things you learn when you're in recovery for codependence is to celebrate the word no. You say yay, because now I know that you're taking care of yourself and I don't have to do it. Yay. Right? Yay! and here's just another little side note on no. You really can't say no. Or no, you really can't say yes until you can say no. Now, if you're just saying yes all the time, it doesn't count. Until you can say no, yes don't count. So it'll be good to learn how to do that. And then the fifth core issue, which is the biggest bugaboo of all, is boundaries. People who have codependency have trouble knowing how to have their boundaries, being able to be self-contained. That's what having boundaries means. I am self-contained. And when I'm self-contained, I'm acting my age. I'm telling you or giving you information about me that I want to, that I've thought about. I know what my emotional reality is. That means I know how I feel inside. I know what I'm doing. I know what I want, I know what I need. And I have all this that is inside of me that is self-contained. Now, it is not a boundary when you start telling people how they need to act around you. That is not a boundary. It's negative control. I know I don't want it when somebody says to me, well, if you're going to be around me, you have this way and act that way and act this way and act this way. It's like, well, I will act however I like because I'm a boundaried person and I don't offend people. So I'll just kind of act the way I am. And I don't like it. I mean, that's just how I feel about it. But I also know that because I reserve the right to act and be and, you know, be who I am and think what I want, that I need to give everybody else that right as well, to respect that right that you have. The only thing I'm responsible for to you or anyone else is how my behavior impacts you. I am responsible for that. Of course, if I'm boundaried and you have a reaction to something I said, if I think that I know what that is and I start acting in a different way, I am now making up a story that may or may not be true. So my job is to ask you, or your job if you have boundaries is to say, you know, when you did that thing, here's how I felt about it and I wish you'd change it in the future. So if everybody has boundaries, then, you know, if I have boundaries, I'm not leaking out all my stuff onto you. And I'm able to keep all the stuff that doesn't belong to me out here. It looks something like this. What's mine's here, what's yours is there. This is a boundary chi. Here's what's mine, that's what's yours. And when I have boundaries, I make a decision when this comes closer or when mine goes out. That's a boundary. When you can have your appropriate levels of self-esteem, know what your reality is, act in moderation, know what your adult needs and wants are and get them met appropriately, and do all of that within a self-containment system for yourself, now you're in recovery for codependence. That's what it looks like. And the freedom it gives you to walk around on this planet is amazing because you're just... It's like what everyone else is doing just isn't my business. So I'm not doing this, even though I really like watching people. I do that. One of those oddballs that do that. And I do make up stories about what I think their history was. Then I see them over doing this, and this helps me in my codependency lectures because I can see you get so good at it that you can watch somebody in an airport and start to think, okay, well, they're doing that and they're doing this and I know that they have these issues and I know that. And it's kind of a practice session. But the most important thing is for me to know it about me. Now, this is also the way that you could stay out of enmeshed relationships. Because, you know, a lot of times people think that if they're going to be intimate, they do this. But actually, that's enmeshment, and they start to feel each other's feelings and know what each other's thinking all the time. And you know, we don't have intimacy unless we've passed each other's skin. That's called enmeshment. And you know, the problem with enmeshment is that people get to the point where they can't move without the other. And here's the real awful thing. I mean, from my world, this sounds really awful. They lose a sexual spark. That's like they're with themselves. Not fun. Sometimes maybe, but not norm. That's not usually why people take all those risks to get in relationships, right? So if you have boundaries, you're able to separate yourself so that when you come together, you are able to experience intimacy for real. Because intimacy is about you knowing who I am, my willingness to let you know who I am, knowing that I will be accepted for that. Not what I do, but who I am as a human being. And if I can feel that from you, and then I give it back to you, we have experienced a real sense of intimacy, almost spiritual connectedness. It's not about becoming one. And become one, you become one. And that's enmeshment. Okay, so, So how does this codependency affect people? How do children who grow up in families that are less than nurturing, or they're being abandoned, abused, or neglected, how does this work in terms of creating this codependency? Well, when a child is in those environments, they have to create distractions, first of all, in order to make it through that experience. Because, you know, whether you're being abused, whether you've been abandoned, whether you feel neglected, it's really intolerable reality for a child to do that, to experience that. And they feel like they're going to die. It's, I'm going to die in here. And then they're afraid they might not. So, I mean, it's like this is the experience of a child that's growing up in this family. And so children distract themselves, and they're easily distractible because they don't have a whole bunch of layers of crap to go through to get distracted. They can be distracted by little or nothing, really. But the first distractions that children create for themselves are three. One is sex. They can soothe themselves sexually pretty easy when they're children. One is food. They can find food to be rewarding, make themselves feel better. But they also start to create fantasies around those two people, primary people in their lives, whose love and affection and attention they cannot get. And children automatically think it's their fault. It's something wrong with me. So if only I do this better, that better, if I'm only nicer, if I only sleep better, if I only do this better, if I only do that better, then those people will like me. And in the meantime, they're also creating a fantasy world around those people. It's like the perfect family, the perfect mother, the perfect father. And if they're in a family where one parent is more frightening than the other one, they'll put the one that's not frightening up on a pedestal and create some big fantasy around them that they're perfect, and then that bad person over there. So that's what children do. They're in the world of, you know, right and wrong and black and white and all that. That's what they think. They're very concrete. So they do this, and then they keep them there through their childhood. This is the bad one, and that's the good one, the wonderful one, the strong one, and the one that I want to be like. That's the one I want to achieve a relationship with. Does this sound like a sex and love addict to you? So when people develop sex and love addiction as a result it's a natural consequence, really, of codependence. It's a natural consequence. People who are addicts of drugs, alcohol, food, sex, gambling, nicotine, shopping, internet, pornography, all those things, all those other addictions except love addiction are just distractions from all of that pain and all those feelings of shame and guilt that children have when they grow up in families that are less than nurturing. So what addicts do, except love addicts, what addicts do out here is they find ways to not notice how awful that feels, to not feel how frightened they are, to not feel the horrible sense of shame, I'll never be good enough, they'll never like me, if only I was a good girl, if only I was a better girl, then it'd be okay. Like, in order to live through that, they create distractions. Food, sex, then nicotine, then drugs, or alcohol, or both. Then, you know, up the ante with all the sex addiction, you know, it's like, oh, then I find pornography, then I find, any number of 1,000 ways to act that one out. And then, I can't do it very well without my alcohol. And I need a few drugs in order to achieve what I really want to achieve. And then I'll go to the internet and find out if there's anything I can do to make that more intense, all right? So all this is going on with addicts, and underneath it all is all the core symptoms of all that addiction. When people get in recovery for their addictions, if they don't deal with their codependence, they are in danger, A, of going out and acting out again and getting in their addiction, But even if they're able to stay in their addiction, like they just never quite grow up. Because that's what codependence is. They're still acting like teenagers in their meetings. You know, it's like go to a meeting and everybody's like hitting on everybody and telling potty jokes. Who does this? My son and his friends used to when they were 13 or 12 or 14. If I'm in an AA meeting, I'm there to save my freaking life. Not to listen to potty jokes or to get hit on. But you see, when people are dealing with their codependence, they aren't acting like grown-ups. You can't have that expectation. But, you know, people can still stay clean and sober and stay out of their addictions and never touch this stuff, but they never grow up either. This recovery from codependency that you're all interested in means that you will grow up, you will get tools on how to deal with the underlying issues. So a young man came up to me earlier today. He's a counselor now. And he said, you know, I learned all about what these things are, but we were told not to even look underneath. Don't do anything psychodynamically. Don't look underneath what is the problem. How did this happen to you? I said, well, yeah, the insurance company pretty much controls what is going to happen in therapy. And no, they don't want to look, they don't want people looking at what caused this because it costs them money. It's not a situation where you're just treating the symptoms. This isn't about, oh, we'll get your symptoms managed, then you go off and you're going to be okay. In this recovery, you find out what your symptoms are, your addictions. You get in recovery for those, and then the real work starts. You start going back and uncover all of the abuse, abandonment, neglect, and the impact of that in your adult life, and it hurts, and it takes time. In fact, if you do it too quickly, you find yourself kind of spinning out of control and feeling like, gee, it'd be great to go back and distract myself again the way I used to, because at least I didn't feel these feelings. All those feelings that you had as a child when you were being abandoned, abused, and neglected, they don't go away. Now, I hear people say, oh, I'm past it. Okay. I can see how you are past that. How many times have you been married? Oh, four? Okay. And where are your kids doing now? And they tell me, oh, well, you know, they're okay. And jobs, are you doing okay in your job? It's like basically nothing is going right in their life. And they keep going back doing the same thing over and over again because, you know, I'm over it. What happens when you really get in there and dig this stuff up, you find out that not only do you have all the same feelings that have been locked away so well inside all those years of when those people abandoned you, abused you, or neglected you, those feelings are still there. And when you start digging down in there and they start coming up, they can be really frightening and they can feel overwhelming to you. But here's the good news is that you already went through it. You don't die from having the feelings about it now. You don't die from that. In fact, when you do have the feelings about that, and you get rid of all the shame and guilt that goes along with it, that you've been keeping underneath there, because you know, I know what codependency is. You walk around, hope nobody really knows who you are. Like, I can't let you know who I really am, because if I do, then you'll find out that I'm worthless. And then you'll find out that you shouldn't be around me. And then you'll find out that I cause horrible things to happen to people. And I know that there's that bad thing in there that everybody can see but me. Okay? So I have to keep it hidden. And what you do when you get in recovery for codependent is that you bring that thing right into light. You make it as bright as you can see it so that you can know the facts of your life. Not the truth that everybody talks about, that truth thing. I don't know exactly. It's really kind of relative when it comes to dealing with this. The facts. What was the fact in your life? How did your parents treat you? What other grown-ups in your life had an impact on you, and was it a loving way? And if it wasn't, then you've got it. Because parents aren't the only ones who have this. You think about all the people in your lives that had access to you when you were a child. You relied on them, you trusted them. Your life was in their hands. Did they treat that life with value? Did they treat it with dignity? Did they treat it with respect? Did they meet that child's needs and wants? Did they understand that every single thing you did was absolutely age-appropriate? Absolutely age-appropriate. No matter if you were smoking dope, no matter if you're caught with your dad's Playboy magazines, no matter if you drove the family car and snuck away with it, you were acting your age. Grown-ups don't do that. Functional adults don't do that. Adolescents do that. And if they didn't know and didn't respect you for acting your age, you felt shame, you felt guilt, you knew there was something wrong with you. And that's the underlying issue. I have people come, they call me up on the phone, I want to deal with the underlying issues, my alcoholism, then I'll quit drinking. Oh, no, you won't. That won't happen. You have to stop your addictions first. You have to be in recovery for your addictions before you can even look at this stuff. It hurts so much. It just hurts. It doesn't mean you're going to die from it. You already survived it. That's why we call the survivors down at the Meadows when we first put this together. And it's still survivors at the Meadows. I changed it to legacy here. Because, you know, it's not just about surviving. It's when you start to act like an adult, it impacts everybody around you, particularly your children. And for those of you who have children, what I can tell you is this, is that all the years I've been doing this, I've noticed that there's this thing I just call grace because I cannot explain it. But when people get in recovery for their codependents, their kids get well. It just happens. And it doesn't matter how old their kids are. Their kids could be 50 and have kids of their own, and all of a sudden, you see all these changes start to happen. That's why I call it legacy. Because it seems to have an impact from the person that, you know, says enough and gets into recovery for their codependence and all their abuse issues, it impacts all the rest of those generations. And I think that's kind of cool myself. I mean, it's kind of like a side effect. Wow, nobody dies. So, okay, there was one other thing I wanted to say about this because she gave me the 5-minute signal. Okay, and that is that, you know, those of us who are in recovery for anything, and just even those of us who just want to become more of who we are, you know, usually the word spirituality comes into this. Now remember when I talked about that you have those different ego states whenever you were abandoned, abused, or neglected? It's like your development stopped, it froze. And it didn't like pick up where it would have been. It picked up where it would have been if you'd never stopped. If it stopped when you were 4 and it picked up again when you were 8, you've got a 4-year span there. That didn't happen, okay? So that's what we call ego state. So you go in, you get into that frozen ego state and you get triggered into that ego state when somebody acts or does or feels something that you felt then. And I hear this all the time, like, she triggers me into blah, blah, blah. And I say, you know what? If I get triggered, I say, thanks for that. Now I know something else about myself. I know that when people act that way, that I feel this way and that helps me in my recovery. Okay? That's really good. She did this! No. She was just being herself and you went into boundary failure. Okay? And now you're down here feeling all those feelings that you had because, gee, they gave you a gift. They triggered you into that and you can do something with it now. And, you know, but of course it's like, but it's her fault. Okay, well, you can give her credit for that if you want to. Or you can, you know, deal with one of your codependency issues. You see, when you're in this recovery process, you really do feel grateful when that happens because you get so much information. So back to what I was saying. So you have these ego states. And so most of the time people have, and it's not just people who are in recovery from codependence, you're just more aware of it, but the world out there accessway. They're either in their wounded child, another wounded child ego state, an adapted adult child, another adapted adult child. So they're like getting triggered all day long, don't know it. Okay? But they're just not acting like functional adults. And then they want peace and serenity. So they've got this little war going on inside between all these ego states. Wah, wah, wah. I want this, I want that. Well, you can't have that because you're not good enough and you've got to earn it. No, no, no. Well, but it's a need. No, it's not a need. It's a want. And all this is going on, right? All the time. And I want peace and serenity. How is this going to happen? How can this happen? I want to have peace and serenity, but I keep that person over there up on the pedestal. And they're so wonderful, and one of these days they're going to notice that I'm wonderful too. And if only I do this or that or the other thing, then they'll love me. And if I just keep being perfect, and if I get more, then they'll love me. And in the meantime, I want peace and serenity. I want contact with a higher power greater than myself. It's not happening. I just don't believe that it's going to happen. Because, you know, and this is another thing that I hear, this complaint when people get in recovery for their codependency. You know you've done it when you feel the feeling of, you think it's boredom. Where's all that drama? That makes me feel motivated. Okay? When you feel that way, you say, oh, this must be what peace and serenity feels like. The absence of chaos. The absence of drama. And I don't even have to go anywhere to get it. It's just not there. And somebody could be over here, Pigpen can walk in with all this emotional stuff. And I'm just over there going, wow, that looks like Pigpen with all their emotional stuff. Do I really want to go over there and jump in with them? Or am I going to just stand out there and go, hey, you know, I really support you in taking care of yourself. I'm not helping them. I'm not fixing them. It's not my fault. Okay? And then I'm just like still here without the drama. I think that's called peace and serenity. So if, you know, a couple of things. If you feel bored, say, oh, I must be getting into recovery from codependency according to Donna. So maybe I'll think this is peace and serenity and see how that feels. Okay, you can do that. Another thing is that when you're in recovery for codependence, it feels weird. So if you're feeling weird and this doesn't exactly feel right, well, that's because you're doing it different. Well, if you keep feeling comfortable, then you're just doing the same thing. So, you know, celebrate when you feel uncomfortable in this process. Celebrate that and learn to say no. It is a complete sentence. Learn to say no. Okay. Am I good? Is that my 50 minutes? You think I'd be good at 50 minutes, huh? Okay. Thank you. Should we go over?
Yeah. Would you like to ask Donna a question or two?
We can have a question or two if you like.
Yeah. Just a couple.
Well, I must have covered it. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What age do?
What age do they become codependent? That's really a good question.
Yeah, I had to kick my 22-year-old out recently.
Yeah, that. That's right.
And you're dealing with the hardest thing as a mother when you talk about legacy. It shook me up because it was a hard thing. I had a few, but in recovery, I had to set the boundaries. And I wanted to come to go to the meeting, but is he good then? That's what I do.
Okay, you know, that's a really good question because people, you know, when I do the legacy workshop, which is, you know, you go through and you, just your deal with your codependence. That's what Legacy Workshop is. It's a 3-day intensive workshop that I do about 8 times a year where you get down and dirty with your codependency, and you get through the stuff, okay? And we only deal with what happened to us between 0 and 17. Now, for parents, I know that, you know, I know in our lives that most kids don't really grow up until they're in their 20s. And it has been my experience that when people come and do legacy before they're fully grown up, they just get really therapy-wise, and then they start using everything they know as a weapon. So, I don't have young people in my legacy groups because I don't want to give them, you know, arm them up to go out and attack their parents. Because this doesn't have anything to do with blame. It has to do with accountability. It is not the blame game, okay? It's like, this is just the fact. This is what happened. This is how it affected me. And whose fault is it? It's not mine. Okay, so in answer to your question, what I would say is congratulations for finally drawing that boundary with your kid. You probably saved his life. Yep. Yep. Yeah, think about it like I'm a flight attendant. When the mask drops down, put it over your face first before you help your children. It's like, don't worry about what they're doing, because the weller you get, it rubs off on them.
Is that right?
Okay, any other questions?
Yeah, one quick question.
Yes.
You were talking about childhood fantasies.
Mm-hmm. Children are really good at fantasizing, and generally it's not really a problem. It's not pathological unless they live in them. You know, really, you know, there are a lot of children who are very creative that do a lot of fantasizing. But you notice it because they have an outlet for it, so they're drawing their fantasies, they're making plays about their fantasies, they're telling stories about their fantasies. The ones I get concerned about, it's like, I think they're in a fantasy because they're not interacting with anybody, and yet they're in there doing something. So that would be of a concern if they weren't like putting them out there and having it be interactive with people. Because, you know, children are automatically interactive. You know, if you ever know of any, they really love to sit by themselves for 2 minutes, maybe. And if there's a grown-up in the room, they just make a beeline to the grown-up, because of course they want, what do children want? They want the grown-up's love, affection, attention, and approval. And so if there's a grown-up within eyesight, that's where they go. And they want all of that from you, and guess what? You can give it to them. But that, I hope that answers your question. Okay. We have the Legacy Center, in case any of you didn't notice. A little table out there, and we're going to be there for most of the rest of the day. And we have stuff about what we do there, stuff about the legacy workshop and all that. And if you want to come and talk to us, please do. That's what we're here for today. So that's it.